good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse.
And the corporate community, the capitalist, has always understood the need to control the political process. And they spend a fortune of money, not just now, not just with big lobbying, not just with campaign contributions, but with a thousand other mechanisms, all of which are funded by the surpluses they control. Who basically take academics, put them in an institution that's separate to generate an endless flow of ideological material to be disseminated through the media and so forth. The political discourse, the media discourse, and the academic discourse have been shaped by the source of the money that makes all of them possible, and that's overwhelming from the surplus. One of the effects of that ideological effort is precisely to keep the question of the organization of production off the political agenda. So, for example, in academic language, which is the part of the world I come from, the way this was done was to develop a discourse, now a good 200 years old, a discourse that works ceaselessly to establish the idea that capitalism as a system of organizing production with private property and markets is the most efficient, technically superb engine of prosperity, efficiency, and freedom. Is spectacular. An effort that understood the need to so establish these ideas that anyone who even opened the question would appear to be a lunatic.
You're listening to episode 6 to 8 of Unwelcome Guests. Asking Forbidden Questions. I'm Robin Upton, and some of those forbidden questions would be: why do people put up with capitalism? Who chose it? Who does it benefit? And how does this square with the idea that we're in a democracy where the majority should have some right to choose what goes on? And elucidating the answers to some of those forbidden questions, and why they never seem to get asked much in the commercially controlled media, by politicians, or by academics, was Professor Richard Wolff, who will be giving us the concluding part of his Marxian class analysis, applying it to the question of, where do we go from here? And regular listeners to the show will of course be familiar with the idea of framing the debate with the fake diversity of opinion, the fact that truly radical opinions are excluded by whatever means deemed necessary from commercially controlled media. So that, for example, I hear recently a Green Party candidate in America was repeatedly arrested for trying to take part in a debate. In our second hour, we're going to hear a short excerpt from Noam Chomsky on framing the debate, a historical perspective on the analysis of Richard Wolff. And that's going to be followed by two more Marxists giving their take on how neoliberalism came to be. Now, I realize, having indirectly criticized those who talk about left-wingers in former shows, this show has actually got a lot of people who do talk about the left-wing, and I will grudgingly admit that it has some use as a historical term, if only because it's been so widely used. I maintain, however, that as a label with which to understand contemporary political movements, it's best avoided because of its deliberately polarizing nature. I reject the idea that there's a small number of opposite opinions about how to deal with the crises facing humanity, to say nothing of there being only two. I instead see that almost all of humanity has very similar goals, albeit we express them in different languages, and most of us have been brainwashed to a greater or lesser extent by a few with deliberately mendacious ideas. But no more from me. This is rather a crowded show, so let's get straight on with the concluding part of Richard Wolff's class analysis. I cut the question and answer section on grounds of time. If you'd like to hear that, you can do so from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/628.
Okay, I want to welcome you to our fifth and final class on class analysis. And today what we're going to focus on is using the class analysis we have been developing and applying to a variety of topics to apply it to what in many ways may be the most important topic we could apply it to, which is an analysis of the possibilities for social change, and particularly for social change on the left, from the left, here in the United States. And to do that, I'm going to break it down into two parts. First, I'm going to talk a little bit in class analytical terms. I'm going to use the class analysis to understand something about the basic history of the labor movement in the United States and the left in the United States. And the second part of what I want to do is to draw the lessons from that history in terms of what might be a new, a different, and a more successful strategy than the one that I'm going to explain has been followed in the past, again, always using the class analytical terms, that is, looking at class in terms of surplus, of the production of surplus by some people, its appropriation by other people, this capitalist arrangement that we went through, and how that surplus then gets distributed. So let me begin with a very brief, because we don't have the time, sketchy history of labor and the left here in the United States. First, labor. Labor in the United States has focused, above all else, in its strategy on organizing workers here in the United States into trade unions, labor unions, in order to, using their language, bargain collectively with their employer. In other words, to change the deal from having an individual worker negotiate with an individual employer about the job, the working conditions, the pay scale, and so on, and rather to bargain with an employer, but collectively, so that all the workers are unionized, are gathered together in a union, literally what the word means, so as to confront the employer as a group, and have, therefore, more bargaining power. The employer can't play one worker off against another because they are unified in a union that bargains for all the workers as a collective. Okay? That's been their goal. And what is it they bargain over? Above all else, and I mean almost exclusively, they bargain over the terms of the labor contract. Literally. How much am I going to get paid? Number one. And what are the conditions of my work? Number two. My medical leave, my holidays, my pace of my work, whatever. And it'll vary from one union to another. So the goal of the American union movement has been to get a better deal when selling their labor power, that is, their workers' capacity to work. The job of the union, in the United States particularly, has been understood. By the way, and not that everybody agreed to this, but the dominant understanding has been the union's job is to negotiate a better deal, get more pay than you would have gotten if you didn't have a union, get better working conditions, medical coverage, pension, whatever, than you would have been able to get if you had bargained individually rather than had a union do collective bargaining on your behalf. Okay? And the interesting thing, and to be fair, is that American workers, at least until the 1970s, but for most of the history of the United States as a country, as an independent country, it is a stunning fact, as I've mentioned to you on our first day in this class, that American workers have in fact enjoyed higher wages. And while there are many reasons for it, one of them is the development in the 19th century of a labor movement towards the end of the century, which worked hard to get higher wages so that the unions have some of the credit for achieving what were pretty unusually high levels of wages for the American worker. And because employers were afraid of having to bargain with unions, they often gave ununionized workers the same wage increases that the unions had won, precisely to prevent their workers from joining a union. You don't need the union. I'm going to give you the higher wage without it. What about the American left in its organized political party forms, but in all of its many incarnations, community groups, social movements, and so on? I think there you see something very different. In general, sometimes with more and sometimes with less enthusiasm, the American left supported the labor movement in pushing for higher wages and better working conditions. But the thrust of the left was usually quite different. They supported the labor movement, but they had their own agendas. And those agendas were mostly about political power and social inclusion. What do I mean? Well, the American left has been, for a long time, interested in bringing into the American culture and the American economy people who, for one reason or another, were marginalized, excluded, limited from participation. Poor people who, because of their poverty, couldn't kind of participate in the cultural and political life. Ethnic minorities, religious minorities, immigrants, women. You get the picture. Bring them in. Represent them. Get them to be within the society. Get them the privileges. Get them the civil rights and the civil liberties. And so a kind of deal was worked out, if you like, a political deal over a long period of time, in which the labor movement generally supported these inclusionary social movements, and they in return generally supported the labor movement in pushing for higher wages and better working conditions. And this alliance sometimes achieved power. You could make the case, for example, that Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal was based on this coming together and mutual support generating electoral victories. Other times, like today, it looks pretty weak and not so effective. That varied. But there's been this left, and they've worked together more or less. And they've had some successes. As I say, we've had very high wages. And we have been, as societies go, not so bad in integrating minorities and women and so forth into our society better or sooner than many other societies have been able to do. So you could even say there have been notable successes in what both the labor movement and the left have been able to achieve. Not what they hoped for, not what they wanted, and in the last 30 years, particularly unhappy results, but nonetheless, let's give them what they were due. But this alliance with this agenda that I just described to you also had profound political costs associated with it. And it's those I want to focus on more. What were the costs? One key cost, because you're going to see where I take this immediately when we start talking about what a new strategy of labor and the left would be. One of the costs of what happened before that I've just described to you is the following. There was little or no attention to the organization of production, to how the enterprise, where you go to work 9 to 5, 5 out of 7 days a week, there was little attention paid to how the organization of work was to be undertaken. That was ignored. It was not considered an appropriate or a possible focus. It was, to make a long story short, left to the powers that be. The capitalists organized the work site and organized the work process. The workers came to work and produced a surplus appropriated by the capitalists. They understood that was their job. They did not understand themselves to have any particular rights to control, let alone transform, that arrangement. What they wanted was to be well paid for what they did, and they wanted good working conditions. But they did not challenge that they were there, that they produced the surplus, the way we went through in when we had our earlier classes. That was, they understood to be what their job was. They went, they produced the work. At the end of the day, they went home. and they left behind for the employer to use and sell as he sees fit the work they produce, the output, their intelligence and their muscles generated. It was a little different in Europe. Europe has a different left tradition from the United States. So, for example, if I had the time, which I don't, I would tell you that in Europe, there was a more classic interest in questions that were secondary here in the United States. First, there was a focus on property. European leftists and even the European labor movement favored social property over private property. They liked the idea that the government became a major actor in the economic system, that it took control, ownership of means of production, of enterprises of all kinds. So the issue of private versus social ownership of productive property was a bigger factor and a bigger issue in European left circles, European social democracy, than it was here. That's an important difference. And secondly, the issue of free market, regulated market. In European socialism, the notion that the government can, should get right in there, regulate and control is a much more developed part of left thinking than it is here. Regulation in the United States is suspected by large numbers of working class people as being unnecessary, unhelpful, and probably bad for working people. It's not considered to be the great solution. In moments of great crisis, regulations, like today, are being brought in. But like today, the working class in the United States doesn't miss the fact that the most enthusiastic proponents of government entering the market right now is the capitalist who's leading the charge. Now, the capitalists want them out as soon as the trouble passes, but while there's trouble, in they should come. So there's something different. But I would argue that in the European, like the United States, again, the focus of labor and the left has been mostly on what in economics we call macro, the big picture, the economy as a whole, the level of wages, the level of regulation, who owns the property, and who's included in the social community, what are the civil liberties. Looking at the organization of production, how production works, who produces a surplus, who gets it, what do they do with it? These were questions that dropped out of the general discourse and the general focus of most elements on the labor and the left. Nor did it make a difference that when Marx's own work enters the picture in the second half of the 19th century and ever since, and even though Marx's work focuses so intensely on explaining where the surplus is and how it's generated and who gets it, all in volume one, and then volumes two and three of Capital, where he begins to look at how that surplus, once it's produced, gets distributed, and how that all this focus on the production and distribution of surplus, even by the Marxists who studied it, is not brought in to the labor and the left movement. What seems to have happened, as best I can tell, is that the Marxism comes in, but is more shaped by what I just described as the interests of labor and the left than it does shape them. It's one of those many examples where a set of ideas arrives into a milieu that more changes those ideas to fit the milieu than that milieu is changed by the new set of ideas, the new insights. So that Marxism has had to struggle, as it still does, to bring the insights of this analysis of production and surplus to become central parts of what a revolutionary strategy of the labor left movement might be. And in the second half of what I'm going to do today, that's exactly what I'm going to try to do. Take that class analytic and show what kind of political strategy comes out of it. Okay. Why then has the left and labor in the United States, granted its successes, nonetheless been on the whole relatively weak, clearly weaker in most ways than its European counterparts for most of its history over the last 100, 150 years? What's that about? How do we account for the relative weakness of labor and the left, notwithstanding the successes and moments of political strength that it did have? And I want to make a general argument that will then be the transition from analyzing what was to analyzing a new strategy, because I'm going to try now to explain why the labor and left haven't been a lot more successful in the United States than they have been, and more successful in the way that we would presumably wish they could be. First, by not challenging the organization of production in the enterprise, what the labor movement and the left effectively did was to support, endorse, leave as is the production, appropriation, and distribution of the surpluses produced in capitalist enterprises, those that Marx called productive enterprises, where the surplus was produced. What does that mean? It means that across the country, in enterprises large and small, in agriculture, in industry, in services, across the board, your organization of production meant groups of workers, 10 here, 10,000 there, came to work and produced commodities that automatically were the property of their employer who sold them. And by selling them, he realized, the employer did, the difference between what it cost him to have them produced and what he got when he sold them. That difference being the surplus. The surplus accrued to the employers. What did the employers do with the surplus? Several things. And I think they explain the weakness of the left. First, when they had to, when there was no option for them, they used a part of the surplus produced by workers to give it back to the workers as higher wages. In other words, to secure the labor supply, they had to rebate to the workers a part of the surplus that the workers delivered to them. Most of the reason this happened in the United States, up until 1970s, when it stopped, and it has never resumed since. Remember that key factor we talked about? The real wage of the American worker today, on average, is about what it was in the late 1970s. So this history of rising wages stopped 30 years ago and has never resumed. But up until then, the major reason capitalists would have to give a portion of the surplus appropriated from their workers back to them as a premium over their wage was because we had a chronic labor shortage in the United States. This had nothing to do with generosity. It had nothing to do with anything other than for an employer to secure a labor force required either inducing waves of immigrants to come to the United States, and that is our history, or to make sure that even if you had a worker, that that worker would not use whatever opportunities arose to leave your job and go and become a farmer on the land that was so plentiful here as we moved west from the East Coast where we began to the West Coast on the other side. So to hold workers once you had them and to bring workers in the numbers you needed them, there had to be a part of the surplus used to provide the rising wages. So that was one way you managed to weaken the left. In a sense, you kept giving workers higher wages over time. I want to remind you the statistic. From 1820 to 1970, the average real wage of the United States workers rises every decade. It's an extraordinary history and helps explain much of what's unique about American capitalism. But capitalists provided that. They got enough surplus from their workers that they could take a portion and give it back and provide higher wages. And the irony was it weakened unions because you got a higher wage without the union. The conditions were such that the union, which kept saying, come here to get higher wages, was always being undercut by the ability to get higher wages without a union. Second, use of the surplus after that. The capitalists used the surplus, this discretionary fund that rolls into their hands because of the structure of production, to make sure that the democratic state, the state that the left gathered more and more people into, the immigrants, the women, and so forth, as we get more and more people in, and there were more and more people in a formally democratic state subject to voting and electoral procedures, the money had to be used to make sure that the people never got control of that government in such a way as to question or challenge the organization of production. So to make a long story short, they used the surplus to buy the government. which is why it is always true of the United States to remind everybody, especially those of us who come from other parts of the world, that we have the best government money can buy. And the corporate community, the capitalists, have always understood the need to control the political process. And they spend a fortune of money, not just now, not just with big lobbying, not just with campaign contributions, but with a thousand other mechanisms, all of which are funded by the surpluses they control. Third thing that the capitalists did with their surpluses, they needed to develop, and they understood in the United States very early, we are the country in which advertising as an industry is born and nurtured. It's one of our proudest exports to those of you in the rest of the world who copy us, even if now you teach us new ways of doing it. Nonetheless, it has been understood the importance of shaping the common mind. And corporations have, and capitalists have from a long time, understood that a very important use of the surplus is to develop and to disseminate ideological arguments about how the world works. It is done by corporate campaigns, by public relations, by academic funding. Universities in our country from the beginning have been subject to and dependent upon largesse from receivers of surplus who basically fund these institutions. In recent decades, we've had an addition, think tanks, agencies who basically take academics, put them in an institution that's separate to generate an endless flow of ideological material to be disseminated through the media and so forth. The political discourse, the media discourse, and the academic discourse have been shaped by the source of the money that makes all of them possible, and that's overwhelmingly from the surplus. One of the effects of that ideological effort is precisely to keep the question of the organization of production off the political agenda. So, for example, in academic language, which is the part of the world I come from, the way this was done was to develop a discourse, now a good 200 years old, a discourse that works ceaselessly to establish the idea that capitalism as a system of organizing production with private property and markets is the most efficient, technically superb engine of prosperity, efficiency, and freedom. Is spectacular. An effort that understood the need to so establish these ideas that anyone who even opened the question would appear to be a lunatic, someone with either an ignorance beyond words or some devious other motive to make them say something so patently absurd. The very idea of efficiency is the center of this. And it's an idea which, if you'll allow me 2 minutes, you ought to have at the back of your mind as a fundamental question, not an assumption. The concept of efficiency works like this. Any event has, the idea goes, a series of consequences. Any event. You raise an interest rate, if you change a price, if you hire a worker, if you build a factory, whatever the event, has a chain of consequences, the argument goes. Some of those consequences are good. Those are called benefits from the event. Some of the consequences that flow from the event are argued to be costs. Okay, with this idea, which is as complicated as making oatmeal in the morning, with this idea, efficiency is calculated as follows. You measure the consequences that are good from an event, the benefits, and then you measure the consequences that flow from this event that are bad, the costs. Here comes the fun part. If the added number of benefits exceeds the added number of costs, you've got an efficient activity. It is a net benefit for us as a community. Isn't that nice? And then, of course, you can compare two events. Event A, costs and benefits. Event B, costs and benefits. And if the difference between the benefits and the events of action A is bigger than action B, don't do B, do A. What's the problem with this idea? Well, I'm going to just put on a different hat. I'm normally an economist, but for a moment I'm going to become a mathematician. Mathematically, what I just said is absurd. And let me show you why. One, how many consequences flow from any event? Answer, you have no idea. It's infinite. It's not only infinite in number, it's infinite in time. You don't know what the consequences are. Some of them won't happen for 10 years. Some of them will happen in a place you didn't look. Nobody knows what all the consequences of any event are. You already know that from your personal life. You say something to somebody, it has a consequence you didn't foresee. Try as you may, this is going to happen to you all your life. We don't understand each other the same way. We don't understand the same words the same way. Consequences are always surprising. So the notion that we can have someone who measured all the consequences is absurd, because if there are infinite consequences of anything, infinity, that's the concept in mathematics, means you can't measure it. That's really all it means. But it's worse. It's worse. Let's go back. What did I say? I said an event has consequences, and you measure the good ones and the bad ones. Here's your problem, friends. The consequences of an event are always the consequences of other events as well. You can't do that. You can't say X happened, then Y happened, and Y happened because X did. Mm-mm. You can't know that. Y happened because lots of things did. There's no way to allocate the effect X from the cause Y, because too many other things are going on. How many other things are going on? An infinity of other things are going on. You'd have to know what all of their impacts were on the thing you're measuring in order to be able to isolate the effect of what you're measuring. You can't do that. The idea of efficiency is a mirage. It doesn't exist. It's a mathematical zero set. There's nothing in it. The only interesting question is how an idea like that could become the measuring rod for everything and anything, including, for example, the efficiency of Soviet planning on the one hand, as opposed to free market. What? What? What are you doing? That's nonsense. It is mathematical zilch. So the only interesting thing is, why is it there? In a few decades, people will look back on discussions of efficiency the way we now look back on those disputes in the Middle Ages between great leaders of the Roman Catholic Church when they had debates, which they did, about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. We giggle. We'll giggle about the efficiency discussion too. The one is exactly as reasonable as the other. But the idea was brilliant. Why? Because instead of understanding the world as a place of struggle, where we want these things to happen and those people want those things to happen, and we kind of deal with why we have these differences and what's at stake in our struggle, we get rid of all of that. We resolve the struggle by measuring in a way that everybody has to bend down to the efficiency of something. So we should all support X because it's the most efficient way to go. Efficiency is a method of browbeating your political and ideological adversary into believing that there is a final resolution to your debate, an absolute truth that all of your disagreements have to bow down to. In the courts of the United States, there are constant struggles between different sides, each of which brings their expert to show that the efficiency argument favors them. On both sides, so it has exactly the same function as the armies that clash at night, each one sure of victory because God is on their side. Efficiency and God are different only in the letters that go into spelling them. It's the same game. It's just a secular form. Anyway, an ideological effort funded by the surplus was produced to make the organization of production a technical matter of maximum efficiency. The capitalist enterprise is then an engine of efficiency that overwhelms all alternatives. That's the function of the idea. Okay. In this story, please notice an implication, and here it is. We don't need a conspiracy theory. No conspiracy defeated the labor and the left movement in the United States. The beauty of what the analysis is I just gave you is that the appropriators of surplus, the capitalists, they're scattered everywhere. You don't need a conspiracy. In the little town, in the pizza shop, in the little workshop, in the factory, in the big corporation in Manhattan, wherever you go, there they are. The capitalists appropriating the surpluses from their workers and using them in the way that is appropriate to secure their situation, to grow their companies. And how do they do that? By paying workers so they keep getting more surplus from them. By making sure the political situation favors them, doesn't provide obstacles to them. And by making sure that ideological communities' ways of thinking facilitate their solving of their problems. You don't need a conspiracy. The beauty of capitalism is it decentralizes and disperses the surpluses all over so that big and little capitalists can get together with problems and disagreements to work out a general way to use the surplus to support and develop capitalism, which is what they have done. What are the resources of labor and the left compared to this? Answer, there aren't any. What workers do with their wages is secure their own lives, pay for their own food, pay for their clothing, pay for their shelter, have some entertainment, raise their families. But they don't dispose of a surplus. The surplus that gets produced is precisely what they don't have. And so they can only support their efforts to shape a public consciousness, to influence politics, by taking money out of their wages and using them for that. And the amount that they can do that is always constricted and constrained. So they're not in a position to fight. This is not a level playing field, friends, to use an American idiom. This is not a level playing field. Okay. What then would I argue is a strategy for labor and the left that, and I'm going to push the point now, is the only way I can see a way forward. And it goes to the heart of everything I've been saying. Labor and the left must begin to deal with, to recognize the organization of production as an issue, as a problem. They have to be able to see, as I've tried to show you, that by not dealing with it, by not making it a contention, by not challenging and changing it, they have basically created their own enemy and the resources that enemy uses to defeat them. They keep delivering surplus, the workers do, to the people who use it to thwart the interests of the workers. And it's worked. Therefore, the lesson would be, it's got to stop. What does that mean? You must, if you have a hope to move the society in a leftward direction, whether that be economically, politically, culturally, you have to do something to shift the surplus from the hands of those who use it to defeat you into your own hands so that you can defeat them. And if you don't do that, you will have the next 100 years look a lot like the last 100. You have to say, and here's the lesson of Marx. That's why he's interesting. Marx says there is a surplus, and here's who produces it, and here's who gets it. All I've done is point out to you what the people who get it use it for. And one of those things is to weaken and undercut the interests and goals of labor and the left. If labor and the left were able to change this, it would be the strongest possible blow they could to the resources being used now to forward and secure an anti-labor and anti-left agenda. It would move those resources into the hands of labor and the left, the majority of people. What would do that? If the majority of people could in some way get their hands on the surplus rather than it being appropriated by those who appropriate it now and who have been showing us how they use it and toward what ends they use it. So how would I do this? How could we operationalize, concretize the implications of this class analysis of production and its impact on labor and the left? And the answer here is really very simple, and we've already encountered it in this series of classes. You need to change the organization of production. It begins this way. In every enterprise, the workers who come to work and do the work are going to become themselves their own board of directors. You're not going to have the relationship between the workers who produce a surplus and a different group of people who get it and use it to reproduce this situation. That's the issue. And you can use a lot of different phrases to make this issue clear, some of which come out of American history. Being your own boss, something which a majority of Americans say they would like. They want that. I'd like to be my own boss. Well, I've just articulated a plan that is the closest you're ever going to get as an average American worker to such a situation. That is, if your enterprise were converted into one in which you as a worker become part of the collective board of directors. That's your best shot. Number two, there is a long history of a kind of enterprise that Americans have been fascinated by, as have others. These are called co-ops, cooperatives. There's a lot in that movement that could be appropriated for this one. Arguments about the benefits of cooperative enterprise, of cooperative work, of cooperative living. That's another route, if you like, another tradition that could be brought in here. But the one I want to stress is this one that I've developed today. That the only way that you're going to change the outcome of the long relative weakness of labor in the left in the United States is if the people who are suffering from that stop delivering surplus into the hands of the people who make them suffer like that. We are funding the institution that thwarts what we try to achieve in life. And that's not very smart. That has to be addressed. Otherwise, what? Let's go through it. We'll find a candidate or even a political party, and we'll work very hard and we'll get them in. But once they're in, they're subject to all of the pressures that come from all of the surpluses that all of the capitalists use to sway, to bend, to block what's going to happen. And they become frustrated and they disappoint us. Another example. We pass a regulation to prevent some bad thing. We've already talked about that. Then the people with the surplus go to work to get around the regulation, to evade it, to weaken it, to repeal it. And they do that. One of the reasons the collapse in 2007 happened in the United States was that 50 regulations passed after the last great capitalist collapse in the 1930s. 50 of those regulations between the end of the 1930s and 2007 were evaded, weakened, or repealed. And that's the story over and over again. We have delivered the surplus into the hands of those who will block the regulations as long as they can, and if they can't succeed at that, will then evade them, weaken them, undermine them, and we sit there waiting for which one is going to happen in what order this time. We're not dealing with the root of the problem. And the root of the problem is a structure that delivers surplus into the hands of people who use it in the way we have been living with. Is that all that has to be done? I don't think so. I think, in fact, if you let yourself think about the social and political implications of workers becoming their own board of directors, of production being reorganized, so it is no longer a conflictual relationship between employer and employee because the same people are occupying both of those positions, I think you'll see where this might go. But let me help you. We have a democracy, we say, in our residences. That is, we have a procedure of voting where we live. You vote where you live. You vote together with other people who live near you for representatives of geographic areas, a ward in a city, a county, a city, a state, a region. And we allow for a certain amount of election to happen where you choose your representatives. But the problem is this, let's call it political democracy, based on residence, where you live, has always been, here we go again, undercut by the absence of any parallel economic democracy. In other words, being able to control your life where you work as well as where you live. My proposal solves that problem. It creates a parallel democratic organization of production. And that's not only good in terms of what it'll do about the surplus, it's also good because it will create the basis for the democracy in the residential area to no longer just be formal, but to become real. Why? Because the workers who live are the same people as the workers who work. And because the workers who work will be controlling the surplus, they will not allow it to be used to undercut the neighborhood where they live, since that would be self-destructive, and people are not normally like that. So whereas, to give you an example, whereas a capitalist enterprise might be willing to beef up profits by using a chemical that pollutes the neighborhood where the capitalists don't live, the workers are unlikely to do it. Unlikely to do it. Impossible that they'll do it? No. I'm not coming up with something that solves all human problems. I'm not an idiot. But it's a movement in a direction that's long overdue and that does solve some very real problems. I mentioned to you before that the wages of workers stopped rising in the 1970s. Why? Let's go over it. What happened? Again, four things. We had a technological innovation called the computer that substituted machines for people on a massive scale. It reduced the demand for labor. Number two, American employers left the United States in record numbers starting in the 1970s, moving production outside the United States. That reduced the demand for labor in the United States. Two major reductions in the demand for labor, but we're not done. At the same time, there were two increases in the supply of people looking for work. Women in America changed. Millions of women stopped being at home and decided they wanted part-time or full-time jobs just like their husbands. And they moved en masse, partly through the women's liberation movement, partly through many mechanisms in the labor force, looking for work. And we had more waves of immigration, particularly from Latin America and secondarily from Asia into the United States. So we had immigrants and women looking for work when there were fewer jobs available. Wages stopped rising and have never resumed. Why? Because a capitalist confronted with a labor market where he doesn't have to raise the wages the way he used to won't do it. And they didn't do it. If workers had run the factories themselves, would they have likely stopped raising their wages? Answer, no. We know productivity kept going up in the last 30 years. So the wherewithal, to the wealth with which to pay higher wages was there. Capitalists didn't use it. We know what they used it for. Starting in the 1970s, they boosted the pay of top managers on a scale we've never seen before. Bonuses, you all read about. They also used that money not only to pay a tiny number of people a vast amount of money, producing an inequality of wealth in the United States that is stunning to look at. That workers in charge of factories would never have done that. Second thing, they used the money to facilitate the export of jobs. American workers would have been highly unlikely to do that. You get the picture? History would have been different. There would have been other problems, surely. But we would have changed our past history in ways that labor and the left wanted and needs. But it would have taken the steps to remove that surplus from being delivered to the people who stopped raising the wages, who moved production out of the country, who substituted for the workers freaked out by the end of rising wages, the mountain of lending to them, which was done with that surplus instead. The combination of the wealth at the one end and the growing indebtedness of the mass of the people on the other, that's what produced the crisis we're now in. That crisis, too, flows out of the structure of capitalist enterprise. And if labor and the left are suffering from that crisis, 15 million unemployed people, 300,000 foreclosures procedures in court a month now. That also is a result that can't please labor and the left and flows again from this same thing. So the central concept I would offer as a new focal strategy for labor and the left is that the organization of production must be on the agenda of social change, and that labor and the left ought to take the position that in the interests of the mass of people, in the interests of democracy becoming real and not just formal, we have to change the organization of production from the way it has been, employer-employee, capitalist-proletarian, to the self-organization, if you like, of workers who become the appropriators collectively of the surplus they have collectively produced in enterprises large and small. And the slogan that would be needed to cover this is simple. We can do better than capitalism. You can become your own boss if we do better than capitalism. It flows, and it's long overdue. The refusal to question and attack and demand the transformation of the organization of production was something the left and labor should never have done. I can close by tying us back with the first class. If you recall, I told you a story about Marx's class analytics. And I told it to you in terms of a little bit of biography of old Karl. Right, he's born in 1818. The great earth-shaking event that all young intellectuals in Europe were completely taken over by at that time was the French Revolution of 1789. It had transformed Europe from the old feudal system that had existed for 1,000 years and ushered in a new world. The slogans of the French Revolution, which reverberated around Europe from 1789 for 100 years, liberty, equality, fraternity. Marx was taken with all of that, as were all the other young left people that were emerging in those years. By the time Marx reaches his maturity, 1840s, right? He's born in 1818, becomes a young man, finishes his education. He's confronted with a fundamental reality, as are all the other leftists. Whatever happened out of the French Revolution, whatever transformations, the end of feudalism, the arrival of modern cities, the arrival of modern industry, the arrival of modern capitalism, when he looked around Germany, where he was born, and then England, where he spent the rest of his life, One thing he was clear on, he didn't see liberty, equality, and fraternity. He lived in London at the time of Charles Dickens. If you ever remember reading Oliver Twist, that's what he saw. That's what he lived. Or Emile Zola in France. Same thing. So he had to face the fact that something was wrong here. Whatever the French Revolution achieved, it didn't achieve what it said it was after, liberty, equality, fraternity. It didn't overcome inequality, it made it worse. It didn't overcome elite control of social life, it just changed who the elite were. It didn't liberate the mass of workers from serfdom and slavery, it made them wage slaves instead. So he had to ask himself, what went wrong? And his answer, 3 volumes of Capital, 3 volumes of the theories of surplus value, was, we, the leftists, the people who made the French Revolution, Robespierre, Danton, all of them, up to him, we didn't see things that had to be changed. We didn't change them, and not changing them undid our project, made us fail. We got to do better next time. We have to figure out what was wrong with what happened in the French Revolution that explains why it didn't work, so that the next time the masses move, they won't make that mistake again. So he uses his exile in London to go to the British Museum and study. And what he decides is, it's about the organization, here we go now, of production. It's about how in the organization of production, there's a surplus produced by some people that other people get and use to maintain this arrangement. And that has all kinds of social consequences. And he gives us examples. He shows us, for example, how this arrangement of production produces a god-awful life for people. That's in the long section of Volume 1 called The Length of the Working Day. A long discussion about how workers, Oliver Twist in England, 16-hour days. Why is that? What is that about? Why does that? He shows us why that happens. He shows us that. See, you have this kind of capitalism. It has that consequence. He does there what I just did again. I'm just copying him. I'm showing you how the organization of production in a factory, the surplus, there, produces a politics that labor and the left loses over and over again. So if you're going to change that outcome, if you're going to have a new, different strategy for the 21st century that is different from the 20th, you have to recognize both what you achieved in the 20th and in the 19th and 20th. Remember, I started today by saying there were some gains, there were some achievements. But more important is you got to look at what didn't work out. And the irony is, here we are, right? 150 years, roughly, since Marx died. And we're still needing people to recognize there's something that this man figured out that we need to understand and use if we're not going to continue to fail. The reason I got interested in Marx is not because he's a nice man or that he's a leftist or that he's romantic. He analyzes, he solves a problem. He's that wonderful character who, having struggled with many of the problems we're facing, figured something out that we can make use of. To not make use of it, to not use his analysis, that's like saying, I'm not going to use fire. Huh? It makes you warm when it's cold. It cooks your food. Use it. Why would the left not make use of this apparatus of insight? That's bad. But to be proud that you don't know and use Marxism? That's beyond words. And most of the American left, including those carrying the name Marxist, never seriously undertook to learn this stuff. It's extraordinary. What you'd learn if you did it is there's some really useful clues about what we need to do to change the situation. Class analysis, and by that again I mean analyzing the organization of the surplus, not who's got a lot of money, who's got not, who's got a lot of power, who's got that. That's interesting. That's not what Marx contributed, and that's not what's missing. We all are sensitive to who has a lot of money and who doesn't, and who has a lot of power and who doesn't. What we have not understood is the relevance, the applicability, the urgency of understanding and changing the organization of surplus in our culture, which is the topic of Marx's mature work. So I've ended this way, trying to make the best case I can for why practical people wanting to make a practical difference in changing modern capitalism have an urgent need to come to terms with, to learn about, and to learn how to use class analysis is the best chance we have to change the world and to change this society. Thank you very much for all your time and for coming, and I hope you found it useful.